And welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. I want to say thanks again to Breathe Bookstore Cafe for providing lunch for our guests today. Wheatberry salad, quinoa salad, garlic, lemon, kale, and for dessert, vegan coconut palm sugar brownies. Breathe Bookstore Cafe, serving vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free, savory, sweets, coffee, tea, juices, and more 7 days a week over on the Avenue, 36th Street in Hamden. Thanks very much. Rona Campbell is here again from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and we'll get to partake of that lunch after this hour is complete. This is the June edition of Midday on the Bay. Hello, Rona. Nice to see you again.
Yes, nice to see you, too. That lunch sounds delicious.
It'll wait till we put some aside for you. Listen, we have a lot to talk about today. Chesapeake Bay crabs. The numbers are dropping again. Scientists aren't sure why. But whatever the reason, more crabbing rules and restrictions are likely coming, so we'll talk about that. And I throw this question out early to our listeners in the hour here today because I know a lot of folks are interested in the plight of the Chesapeake Bay blue crab with these numbers dropping, concerns about the future here. You know, I've suggested in my column in the Baltimore Sun a couple of times now a moratorium on a harvest of the blue crab in Maryland, Virginia for 1 year. And get all kinds of interesting responses to that. We welcome more comment about it today. What do you think about that idea? 410-662-8780, the Midday email address, to send in a comment on that, midday@wypr.org. Go on my Facebook page, post comments there. We're looking for comments on that particular subject, a moratorium on the crab harvest. We had one on rockfish. And between 1985 and 1990, or 1984 and 1990, and it did wonders for the rockfish. Here it is, 24 years later. We have problems with the rockfish. The rockfish, the numbers are in decline. Rona's going to tell us about that, too. So we'll talk about crabs, and we'll talk about rockfish during this hour. But first, Rona, let's start with another subject here in the first segment of the show. The Baltimore Harbor. This story was out a couple of weeks ago. The Baltimore Harbor got its report card, and for the second year in a row, it earned an F. And, you know, Rona, if your little girl, if your daughter brought home a report card like that, you wouldn't be too pleased, would you?
Well, she's only in third grade. Do they give Fs in third grade?
I don't know.
But yes. Absolutely. That is not a good grade. But there are a couple things to note with that grade. First of all, we've only been grading the harbor for 2 years, so we need to keep that in mind. Second of all, believe it or not, even with an F, it improved slightly over last year. And third, as you might note on a child's report card, there is room for improvement. There are many things we can do to get that poor grade up, possibly to a D next year.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the grades. What's being graded here? What's the harbor being judged on, basically? And who's doing this, by the way?
The graders are a combination of scientists with the University of Maryland and advocates in Baltimore, and they're going out and measuring the water, taking samples, looking at indicators, and putting the information together to come up with a percentage that translates into a letter grade.
Okay.
At the harbor, they're looking at seven things. Fecal bacteria, which comes from sewage, chlorophyll, which is algae, something called conductivity, which comes from salt and chemicals, dissolved oxygen, which is what makes it possible for the critters to breathe, water clarity, which you need for photosynthesis and for fish to be able to find their prey, and nitrogen and phosphorus, which come from soil erosion, sewage, and stormwater.
Wow, boy, they look at a lot there. So of all those, where did we do the worst? Did the report say and why?
Yeah, it gives a good map and shows kind of where we did worst and what was worst.
You mean an actual map of the area?
Yes.
Leading to the bay?
With letter grades, yes.
Leading to the harbor?
Yes. Huh. And you can go on the Waterfront Partnerships website and find it. The Bay Journal also has a link in my story to the report, or it should. So the entire harbor scored an F, and that would be the inner harbor, the middle branch, the mainstream of the Patapsco. Most of the streams leading to the harbor, including one near my house, Towson Run, scored an F.
So they actually grade the little creeks that run down to the Jones Falls that run to the harbor and all
yes,
that.
Oh, they do. Oh. And probably not every single one, but, you know, the bigger ones.
You said Towson Run?
Towson Run, which is right near Towson University, by that footbridge near Burke and Bosley Avenue.
Huh.
You might not have even noticed.
Yeah, I've noticed that, yeah.
There's water down there, and there's all this impervious surface around it, and then there's the stream.
Okay.
Stony Run, which is a popular stream around here, a good place to walk a dog, got an F. But some streams in the watershed did better. Dead Run, for example, is not so dead. It got a D, and its sister stream got the highest grade, a C minus. In general, the Gwynns Falls did better than the Jones Falls, and I suspect that's because of the building boom and the impervious surface in the Jones Falls,
okay,
which seems to be more than in the Gwynns.
But any surprises in the report that you would call a surprise?
Yeah, there were a couple. Baltimore Streams got an A for turbidity. That means the water clarity. And actually, on Sunday, I was out at the Cromwell Valley Stream with my children, and I couldn't believe how clear the water was.
This is out in Baltimore County.
Out in Baltimore County. Now, this is a very good sign for all sorts of reasons. Plants will grow, fish will thrive, but we need to remember it's also a very short-lived phenomenon. The next rain and that clear water gets cloudy. So the good news is it doesn't take too long to clear it up. But the bad news is that it gets cloudy every time it rains, and it rains a lot around here now. Dissolved
oxygen. Isn't that natural, or is it because of all the runoff?
It's because of the runoff. Yeah. It's not so much a problem with the rain itself, although the rain is picking up some particles from the air pollution. It's all the stuff that the rain is picking up, including trash and other debris that's getting into the streams.
Right. So you have to remind people sometimes that way back, long time ago, when there were more trees, there wasn't as much cleared land. There wasn't as much erosion. There wasn't as much runoff. That's all there is to it.
As far as
the turbidity, maybe they measure by how quickly it clears up. Is that it?
They go out and sample at various times. I think at certain times of the year, they're sampling it weekly. And they look at it before rains and after rains to see kind of how it is. So believe it or not, even though this seemed like a year with a lot of rain, it was 2013 was actually an average year. So because it was an average year, they're able to get a pretty decent picture of what it was like. The other piece of good news is that dissolved oxygen, which is a huge problem in the bay. We talk about the dead zone in the Chesapeake Bay. These streams scored pretty well on dissolved oxygen. So that means that there is a capability of a lot of life in these waters. Indeed, at Cromwell Valley.
So the streams are doing better when it comes to that. It's just that by the time it gets into the deep part of the bay, we have these dead zones.
Right. And the bay's got all kinds of other problems. Lots of things feeding into it, whereas the stream, it's a little more controlled in terms of what's going into it.
I want to ask you about the Baltimore Harbor. One big question here. I think we talked about this before, because we've had the Waterfront Partnership on, or at least I've talked to folks there.
Right.
And I remember when they rolled this out a few years ago, they said they wanted a fishable, swimmable harbor. A harbor you could swim in by 2020, I think it was. Right? Am I right? It was 2020? So what do you think? I mean, it just doesn't seem realistic.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen by 2020. But to me, Dan, the year is not really what's important. What's important to me is that people believe in the harbor again, and that they believe in Baltimore again, and they see Baltimore can become a city like Boston.
Oh, that's when we discussed
right,
it. The exactly. Charles River, right? The
right.
Charles
and,
River.
When I was in Boston a few months ago, I was there for a food boot camp at MIT, and I was there for a week.
A food boot camp?
Right, yes.
Can you take a sidestep and just tell us what that was? What was that about?
Yes, it's this MIT has a program for science journalists, and they do all kinds of different things. They have about three of them a year, and this one was all about food science. So it was about kind of how we grow our food, how we get fat, how we eat too much sugar, what we can do about it. So for personal and professional reasons, I was interested. So I went for a week, and the entire time I was there, and I mean, we were pretty much in class all day, but I did a couple Bay Journal stories, and I was out and about. And the entire time I was in Boston, I didn't see one piece of trash on the street. I didn't see one person throwing a piece of trash. I didn't see one piece of trash in the water. And in Baltimore, just now, I parked my car on Charles Street. I got out and I noticed my wheel is on top of a soda bottle that's half full of Orange Crush.
Yeah. It's all around here. I mean, right out here near the radio station.
Your particular area, I think, is a little worse than a lot of other places because there aren't as many trees on this part of Charles Street. But all over Baltimore, you see that.
And now they have this new machine down at the harbor to catch all this stuff that flows into the harbor.
Yes, right? which is great. And one of the great things about that tool is hopefully people will see all the trash and they will ask themselves, how did this trash get here? And then they will change the behavior.
You know, I grew up in the Boston area, and that
right.
song, Love That Dirty Water, you know, Boston, You're My Home, right? That was about the Charles River.
I think 40 years ago today it came out. I think it's an anniversary
You're
today of
kidding.
That song.
Did you look that up?
No, someone on Facebook put it up.
I just love that dirty water. I remember that song, right? Well,
right,
that
right.
was a big embarrassment to actually, I think that song had a lot to do with getting them moving up there to clean up the Charles River.
Yes,
which,
it did.
When I was growing up, was called the Charles River. Now it's the Charles River. But anyway, so they didn't just write it off. You know, a lot of people just think, well, it's all polluted. It'll never come back. But
What's interesting about that song now is I'm told that they sing it at Red Sox games when the Red Sox win. And that it's become a song that is celebrating Boston. And one of the reasons why you can kind of get away with that is because Boston doesn't have dirty water anymore. So they're singing about something that they don't. If it was truly polluted, I don't think there would be as much joy in singing that song. But
the thing is, with the Charles River, there's all this recreation associated with it now.
Right.
A lot of boating out there. There's people just walk near it. It's a great environment, the Charles River.
Right.
And it's true. You saw that when you were at MIT.
Oh, yeah. Well, we saw crew boats. We saw, I mean, it was freezing and people were still out there running. I was out there running. It was about 20 degrees and people were still using the river like it was their personal gym. And I think people are starting to do that in Baltimore. There's a lot of kayaking and canoeing on the Inner Harbor and in the areas around the harbor. So people are starting to recreate there. And I think there is this sort of greater understanding that cities don't have to be polluted and that they can be better.
Well, look, you know, over the last 40 or 50 years, what was an industrial waterfront has become increasingly residential, an office tourist waterfront in the Baltimore Harbor all the way out to the east side, the southeast side. Now we're, you know, Dundalk wants to push the fact that it's on the water. So people like property on the waterfront. You got to get them interested in the water itself and making improvements. But is that realistic? What needs to be done? What could be done in Baltimore? What do you think?
Well, there's a few things that need to be done, and some of them are finally being done. Stormwater is a big thing. We have a few really good examples of people who are tackling the stormwater problem, smaller communities that are doing it on their own. Infrastructure is a big problem. We have pipes that don't connect to other pipes and systems that aren't talking to each other and really old infrastructure. And Baltimore now has the right man for the job, I think, in Rudy Chow, who's the new public works director. He really understands this. He was with the Washington Sewage Authority for many years. And we also need to change our habits. And we need to just become better stewards of our environment and believe that it is possible to have a nicer environment.
Okay. I'd like to hear from folks who are interested in the Baltimore Harbor and improving the water quality there. You're welcome to give us a ring. This is Midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here with Rona Cabell, staff reporter for the Chesapeake Bay Journal, who joins us once a month to talk about issues environmental regarding the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about rockfish in trouble, crabs on the brink again, and watermen fighting for their own survival. And again, that question about a crab harvest moratorium. Maryland and Virginia, do you know enough to say one way or the other? And if you've been informed about what's going on, if you follow the news at Rona's Journal and the Baltimore Sun, wherever you get your news about the crab harvest and the number, well, actually the crab population, what do you think about a one-year moratorium? It helped the rockfish years ago. Could it help the blue crab? 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday. Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell, staff writer for the Bay Journal. Maryland has long regarded the comeback of the striped bass.
Striped.
I'm sorry. That's my New England thing. I grew up, I never knew the term rockfish till I moved to Maryland in the 1970s. And when I was growing up, there was striped bass, stripers in Massachusetts. So it's actually the striped bass.
Right.
Known here as the rockfish. And this, we've always considered this a great success story. Sometime in the 1980s, I think it was 85 or 84, 85, you know, things were bad in the 80s as far as the numbers went. And the state put in a moratorium. But now it was 24 years after that ban was lifted, Rona. So it was lifted in 1990. We have this news. You've had it in the Bay Journal. Tim Wheeler had it in the Sun. This stock assessment showed the number of rockfish, particularly females, are reaching unsustainable levels. a cut of 1/3 could be coming soon in terms of the amount of harvest that they allow, commercial harvest, right? So right. Tell us a little bit about here. What the numbers show in terms of the rockfish?
So you're right. The rockfish have sort of been in a, anecdotally, there have been reports of a steady decline in rockfish. And the stock assessment, which the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission undertook, they managed the species on the coast, showed that the rockfish were at what they consider unsustainable levels. And so they're recommending a 1/3 cut. And what that would mean for the Chesapeake Bay's watermen is there are 5.8 million pounds of striped bass that are harvested annually commercially. Nearly 4 million of those come from Maryland. So Maryland has a huge striped bass fishery. It is one of the last viable commercial fisheries in Maryland. And the guys, mostly guys, but the men and women who fish for striped bass are holding on tightly to one of the last ways they can make a living on the bay. So they obviously don't want to cut, and it would affect them very deeply.
Okay. So what's going to happen? Are we going to see cuts?
Well, yeah. Fisheries management is sometimes more about politics than about science. Often more about politics. And the head of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Service did go before the commission and ask for, instead of a 1/3 cut right away, sort of a gradual 10% cut phased in over 3 years. They are studying this. But one of the things, Dan, that a lot of fishermen, recreational fishermen, complain about is that the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission takes a really long time to make decisions.
And that's the commission that manages the striped bass or rockfish population?
Yes, they manage that. They manage menhaden, and they manage a whole bunch of other species that migrate up and down the coast. Mm-hmm. And one of the recreational fishermen said in the Baltimore Sun, they have made kicking the can down the road into an Olympic sport because they just take a really long time. And a good example of that is the menhaden cut. There were, for years, probably decades, there was indication that there was a problem with the menhaden because omega protein in Virginia was just taking out millions of pounds of menhaden every year with these spotter planes and this huge operation down there to make omega-3 fatty acids and pet food and other things. And it was not until 2012 that this commission acted to put in a cut. And they put in a 20% cut on the menhaden harvest. And it was extremely controversial when they did it. Omega objected. The unions objected. Jobs, they said, might be lost. But it was about 5 years after they first discussed doing it that they did it, maybe longer. So it's just a very slow process to put in any sort of restriction. And part of that is just because of the political nature of it.
Can you tell us today whether that's made any difference so far? Or is it too early to tell yet?
I think it's too early to tell. The Maryland watermen have recently sued the Department of Natural Resources because the cut against omega, the 20% cut, affected all the states. Even though Maryland doesn't have a huge bait fishery like Virginia does, the Maryland commercial watermen who caught menhaden also had to take a cut.
What's the suit about?
The suit is about them saying that the cut was unconstitutional and that they shouldn't have had to take it. And we never really got to hear the arguments because a judge dismissed the cut.
I don't understand this. The commission in this case, you say they take a long time. Yet they're informed by science, right?
Right.
Just as our Maryland Department of Natural Resources, the Fisheries Service, informed by science.
Right.
Chesapeake Bay Foundation, informed by science. So there's been, as long as you've been covering the environment in Maryland and the Bay, there's been this fight between what the watermen think they know or say they know by instinct or by experience versus what the science says. And it's an imprecise science, predicting what the crab population is going to be in a year, what the rockfish population is going to be in a year, how many menhaden there are going to be per square mile in next year. This is an exact science. I think we all know that, but at least it's science, right? So there's always been this battle between the commercial interests and the science, and the politicians get in the mix too.
Right. And it used to be, back in the days, the political winds were very favorable to the watermen. And we talked about this before, that, you know, back in the 19th century and 18th century, due to pervasive racism and the fact that African Americans didn't count as a whole person, there was a disproportionate amount of representation on the Eastern Shore and in rural Maryland. And the legislators that went to Annapolis had the rural voice had a voice disproportionate to the amount of people. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, watermen were able to get a lot of things from the state that over time that eroded. But at the, you know, certainly in the 1800s and through the early 1900s, there were a lot of concessions given to watermen. There was a time when the Department of Natural Resources bought oyster seed and moved it around for the watermen based on where the watermen wanted it.
There's a tradition of a lot of power there.
There was a tradition of a lot of power, and that has eroded slowly and then sort of more quickly. And at a point now, watermen are really fighting to get to hold on to their way of life and to be able to have any fisheries that are healthy. And, you know, part of what's going on now is there's a bit of a battle between the new Department of Natural Resources Secretary Joe Gill, who came from an enforcement background. He was an assistant attorney general, and the watermen, who are not really united anymore since the sad passing of Larry Sims, who kind of held the group together. He was the president of the Maryland Watermen's Association. So there's, you know, the interests are sort of disparate. There's guys who fish for rockfish, there's crabbers, there's aquaculturists. They're not all united. But, you know, one thing is for sure, that their way of life is slipping away from them. And part of that...
Well, it's because of the resource.
Part of that
life wouldn't be slipping away from them if the resource weren't slipping away. Look what
right.
we're talking about today. Declining crab population, declining rockfish population again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And water quality that's terrible still.
Right.
Getting a flunking grade. So you put all that together, no wonder we're losing the resource.
Right.
There's something wrong. We're not doing enough.
Right.
Right. So
yes.
So when the watermen say you can't deprive us of a job, I got all these letters from watermen saying, how can you call for a moratorium on the crab harvest? What do you know about it? You know, it's one
right.
of these. I'm ignorant. I'm a landlubber. I don't go on the bay. I don't harvest crabs. I don't know what it's like out there. And I just go by what we're being told, that the fishery, the crab fishery, is in collapse again. Well, we've had these warnings before. 1995, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation said that the crab population in the bay was, quote, perilously close to collapse.
Right.
1998, Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Chesapeake Bay Program, excuse me, which is the regional program that studies these things, said that the crab population in the bay was fully exploited. That was the phrase they used, fully exploited, warning that Maryland and Virginia watermen could harvest no more than they were already taking without threatening future generations of crabs. And even that, I got to say this, I guess I got to add this in here. Even during that period of time when there was all this stress on the crab population, calling it fully exploited, perilously close to collapse, they still took an average of 42 million pounds of crabs out of the bay each year.
Right.
I mean, and watermen say, well, that ain't so much. Well, wait a minute, 42 million pounds, this sounds like a lot to me. So now we have this report that the crab population is declining again.
Right.
And they're very concerned about the females in particular.
Right. What I would say about that, and you're probably going to disagree with me, but so the difference between a rockfish moratorium and a crab moratorium and an oyster moratorium is a couple things. The rockfish live much longer, and they their spawning cycle is different. And I don't think there's any question that the rockfish moratorium back, you know, 25, 30 years ago was saved the population. And I think even watermen will acknowledge that it was a good thing and it saved the population. The difference with a crab population is crabs don't live as long. They live 2 or 3 years. And they have a different sort of spawning cycle where the female mates and then holds the eggs and then kind of spawns when she's ready and can have a few broods in her lifetime. My issue with it is this. I think there are so many things going on right now in the Chesapeake Bay that are harming the crabs. I'm not a scientist. I don't have all the answers. I don't think the scientists have all the answers. But I think we've got tremendous pollution. I think we've lost a lot of habitat. We have a bay that is heating up, you know, because of the climate change. We have also this issue where the baby crabs are going out to the ocean after the females spawn. They go out to the ocean on the currents, and then they, as megalope, which is like a baby crab, they hitch a ride back into the ocean, and they're not coming back.
No, back into the bay.
Back into the bay. They're not coming back, not in the numbers that we used to see. So why is that? What's going on? And then we have just the...
So because you don't know, and because of all those factors, I say, why don't you just lay off for a year? Leave them alone for a year, 1 year. And what do you do with the watermen, Dan? Well, you give them, you'll find other jobs for them. We'll find other jobs. We'll deal with that next. But the first question for me would be, why not just leave them alone for a year? See what happens.
Well, the easy answer to that is that it would be economic devastation. And I don't know what it would really get us in terms of information. Now, we put a major cut on the harvest in 2008. And we saw a lot of complaining from the crabbers, but they accepted it and they followed it. And what we saw was a bounce for a couple years in population. And we were excited because we thought that this thing we did worked. But then we've seen 2 or 3 years of not very good. And this year, last year, I think was the worst crab harvest in 2 decades. And I was out on the Eastern Shore last week and I heard that it's not good at all. In part, that's because the water's still cold. But
the number of females has dropped below the levels science believes necessary to sustain the overall population. So I say leave them alone. All right. Take a year off from crab harvest. And you say it would be devastating? I don't know about that. Let me go to Rick. Rick has a question that's key to this discussion we're having right now. Rick in Bel Air, we welcome you to Midday on the Bay. Dan and Rona here. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me that a moratorium on crabbing for a year might be beneficial to the crab population, and it's obvious it will have a devastating impact on crabbers. But I'm curious as to what percentage of blue crab that we consume here in Maryland actually comes from the Chesapeake Bay versus the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, I don't know the exact what percentage it is, but almost every time someone in my family wants to have crabs, it's often crabs either from Virginia or certainly from the Gulf Coast, depending on the time of year.
Yeah, I think around right now, it's probably going to be mostly not local. It's just because our waters are cold. And interestingly, I was talking to a fisherman yesterday, and he said, I was kind of running my theory by him about all of our pollution and habitat loss causing these problems. And he said, well, Rona, look at Louisiana. They just had an oil spill and they're having the best crab season of their lives. So, you know, I could be wrong.
Right.
But, you know, so yes, most of the crab that that we are eating around now, like if you would go to a restaurant, I'm thinking it's probably Gulf Coast or maybe Virginia. As you get later into the summer, it should be more local.
I'll give you some numbers here that came out from this report in late April, early May. I noted that back in the 90s when we had those reports about how the crab population was in collapse, perilously close to collapse, we were still averaging 42 million pounds out of the bay each of those years in the 90s. In 2012... last year, 2013, last year's estimated harvest was 19 million pounds. That's the lowest on record.
Right.
Tim Wheeler established that was the lowest that they had a record of. So if you're that close, if you're only harvesting 19 million, I know it sounds like a lot, but if you're down to that level and there's going to be more restrictions, then why not just take a year off and find some way to compensate eligible watermen for compensation. Find them some other jobs. I even said one time, put them out planting trees. Plant trees. We need trees. Do something as part of the stormwater projects that are
right,
coming
right.
online now from the stormwater fee. We're gonna take some calls about this.
Okay.
It's Midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here with Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. You can tell us what you think about this. Join us. And if you're a waterman and you have time, give us a ring, 410-662-8780. We're going to take a break. We'll come right back. I have some emails to read and some comments that have been posted on Facebook on this very subject. Dan Roderick's here, back with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. A question on Facebook you were referring to earlier, the report card on the Baltimore Harbor, and we noted that specifically there was a map that showed grades of the grading of the streams that contribute to the bay, to the harbor. And where can we find that?
I thought I linked to it on my article on bayjournal.com. If I didn't, you can go to the Baltimore Waterfront Partnership, and they should have the report card up on their website, and you should click on it. I will make sure I post it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page so that anyone who hasn't been able to find it can find it there.
All right. And that'll give you grades and all the tributaries that they graded in terms of that. 410-662-8780 is the number here for Midday if you want to comment on that, on cleaning up the harbor, or on the idea of a moratorium on the crab harvest. And if you have any experience out there with the rockfish, recreational fishing, commercial fishing. So what's going to happen? We need to wrap up on the rockfish. There's going to be a cut in the harvest, do you think?
Yes, I think they're looking at it. They're going to continue to study it. But it was recommended that they do this 10% cut every year over 3 years, as opposed to, you know, hitting it all at once. So, but I think they're still deliberating. This body meets, I think, 3 or 4 times a year. So,
Ken says the most important part about getting a clean harbor on that subject is getting the word out. If we can make the majority of Baltimoreans aware of just how bad the harbor is, then we can get people to do the little things needed to clean up the harbor, like cutting down on street pollution or sewer dumping. There must be a way that we can use the National Aquarium, arguably Baltimore's main attraction, and its conservationist views to help spread the word that we Baltimoreans need to take action on this matter. Thank you, Ken. John Racanelli, the CEO of the National Aquarium, will be on Midday on Friday, Midday Friday noon hour, and we'll talk to him about that. Let's take another call. Michael from Pennsylvania, you're on Midday on WYPR. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions. One regarding crabs and the moratorium. I agree with that, but I'm just wondering if there is an easier way by just putting a moratorium on these all-you-can-eat crab feasts that we see, as well as harvesting female crabs. I remember when I was growing up, we'd throw the females back. That just seems like a simple solution to the problem. And secondly, regarding quality of the bay, If we're that concerned about the quality of the bay, then why do we continue to develop the waterfront, building houses on, you know, along the bay with large lawns and that kind of thing? There seems like an inconsistency there.
I don't think too many people are making that connection, but you're right. I mean, if we want to preserve the quality of the water, then we do need to kind of think about, you know, how we're developing and if we're fertilizing lawns to the edge of the bay. Now, Maryland has a law, the Critical Areas Law, that controls some of that. I don't know if there's an equivalent of that law in Pennsylvania. Then again, I guess you don't have Bayfront, but you have Susquehanna Front. On the crab question, it's interesting. Everybody kind of has their own, version of what's correct. I used to be shocked when I realized that in Virginia, what they did with the pregnant females is they simply pulled off the orange sponge and then they ate the crab. And I thought, how could you do that? You know, it's a pregnant female, you should leave it. And then someone brought up to my attention that every female crab that you catch in Maryland, it may not be pregnant yet, but it's just a matter of time before it becomes pregnant, because it takes the sperm and holds on to it. So is it any more wrong to catch a pregnant female crab that isn't pregnant yet, mm-hmm. or to catch it when it is? So that's an interesting question. There have been a lot of the restrictions that came in 2008 were on the females. And as I mentioned before, they helped temporarily, but in the long run, they haven't seemed to have really help the population.
You know, you're referring to 2008.
Yes.
The U.S. Department of Commerce declared the crab fishery a federal disaster.
Right.
And it made Maryland eligible for millions of dollars in aid for watermen, remember?
$15 million.
I mean, if you do it could be more, maybe.
Split between Maryland and Virginia. And they used that money to encourage watermen to get into aquaculture, to provide low interest loans, help them make cages, all kinds of restoration work in the bay. Part of it went to removing these, what you call ghost pots, these derelict crab pots that catch a lot of crabs by accident. So the money was put to use employing watermen for other endeavors.
It's funny that Tom mentions all-you-can-eat crab feasts. That wasn't Tom. I'm sorry. I forget who the last caller was. I forgot his name. But Pennsylvania,
call
him. somebody else said to me, you know, it's a terrible waste. People waste, when it's an all-you-can-eat crab feast, they waste all... Yeah, I mean, I don't know that how that helps us in regard to the harvest and increasing the population, making it healthy again. But it's just a sort of a bad practice. And I went to a crab feast; it was all you can eat, and it was true. A lot of people they're not as diligent about eating as much of it as possible as they are when they're paying by the dozen. Dennis and Sparks, you're up next. You're on Midday on the Bay. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just wanted to get some historical perspective here. I was an oyster diver in the 80s, mid and late 80s, when MFX and Dermo first hit.
Mm-hmm.
And we could see that there was obviously a problem, a lot of boxcars, you know, a lot of dead oysters. The watermen at that time were going to the state and asking for extra push days for the skipjacks. You know, they actually pushed the skipjacks with dinghies with like 454 motors in them.
Mm-hmm.
And they could do that 2 or 3 days a week. And when there was obviously a problem with the resource, you know, their response was to, you know, go to the state, ask for an extra push day. And if you push a skipjack through an oyster bar, I mean, you can obviously do a lot more harvesting if there's anything there or a lot more damage.
So, yeah.
There's always been this clash.
You're saying it was obvious to you what was going on with the oyster population. It was obvious to scientists, but the watermen were fighting it despite that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually corresponded with Bill Goldsboro at the time because the buyers, you know, we go to the buyers every afternoon when we got back, and we would start in Oxford, go out to the Chow Tank Light, and work our way north up the bay. And, you know, everybody could see that the oysters were smaller, the big oysters were dead, tons of boxcars are empty shells.
Right.
You know, and you go to, you know, because we were down there, could see it, I guess, you know, we were the first ones to really know what was going on, what was going on.
But
there was this tremendous lag time in an obvious problem and what, you know, could have been a response that would have probably, you know, been a lot better than extra push days for the skipjack.
Thank you, Dennis. Thanks for that call. He referred to Bill Goldsboro there, a scientist.
He's with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Yeah, and there was one other thing I wanted to point out. He brings up a good point as an oyster diver. There was a standoff recently in the Little Choptank River between oystermen and the Department of Natural Resources. The Department of Natural Resources closed an entire area to oyster restoration, and they've been buying fossilized shell from Florida and putting it in the area to help grow the oysters. It has been a pretty big success in terms of getting the oysters back and recruiting natural oysters to set on these shells. But in closing off the area, they've taken away some areas where crabbers crabbed. And so the watermen feel that the fossilized shell they're putting down is causing over sediment in the bay. So there was a protest basically a standoff at the Little Choptank where the watermen came and met the DNR boat. And the DNR decided to come back another day. I think over the years, there has been a lot of, I guess you'd call it self-interest in terms of preserving the waterman's way of life and fishing the oysters. But I do think now there's this recognition among the watermen that there's a problem. And there's this, I think there's a push to try to understand what's going on environmentally to fix the problem. I think they know a crab cut's coming, but they're also, the ones I've talked to have said, you know, you can't just keep cutting us. There's something more going on here in the Chesapeake Bay.
Kristen in Baltimore, you're on Midday next. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to have to figure out how to turn my cell phone off so that I don't, my radio off. Are you getting feedback?
No, you sound fine, Kristen. Go right ahead with your point.
Oh, terrific. Okay. I have two short points to make, and then I'll take my comments off the air. My first one is that I tend to think that it doesn't require either a science background or the lifelong experience of a waterman, but there just seems to be a whole bucket load of common sense here, being able to draw the line between, you know, cause and effect, and number one. Number two, and the old commonsensical saying of, look, penny-wise, pound-foolish, take some severe measures now in order to preserve the resource for the long haul. So that's one thing. Another thing is, I wanted to put out the idea of putting water into work, perhaps taking some climate control preemptive measures, such as building dikes that would protect some of the Chesapeake Bay islands. So those are my two comments.
On the moratorium for a year question, my only concern with that is, what do we get out of that if the crabs just die, if they don't live? I mean, I think what we need to do is figure out what is going on in this Chesapeake Bay.
I'm not saying we don't. Yeah, there's a lot to go on. There's a lot that we have to do. I agree with all of the points you made earlier about all the conditions that may be contributing to the drop in the crab population.
Right.
I'm just saying, in terms of us, we humans and what we do, why don't just leave them alone for a year? There's my that's a common. Yeah. It seems instinctual and common sense to me. If remove one of the pressures. The one pressure we can control is our harvest of them. That's all I'm saying. You can't control the weather. There's a lot you need to do with pollution yet.
Yeah.
But do the part that's the human part. Eliminate our harvest of them.
And what kind of mail have you gotten on this? I'm curious.
Well, it's been mixed. It's been mixed. I would say the people who have an interest, people who own crab houses, restaurants, watermen, are all, think I'm ridiculous to suggest that. And then I got other mail from people who say that they see the point. What could it hurt? I'm not sure they see the economic devastation that you're suggesting, because so many of our crabs come from out of state now to begin with, our Gulf Coast crabs.
That's true, they do. But,
I mean, what is the season of actually eating, consuming Maryland crabs? Would you say it's August to late September? Early October is when most Marylanders know that they were going to probably be able to get a Maryland crab or a Virginia crab.
I would say that there's that, but I would say that there's more than that. I mean, we think of it as okay, we go to a couple crab feasts a year, we eat crabs, we're done. But I was on Hooper's Island last week. Hooper's Island is an island of about 300, 400 people, three low-lying towns. One is gone, one is on the verge of gone, and the other one is high ground. And everybody there pretty much is a fisherman. They either fish rockfish, they fish crabs. There are about 10 or 12 small processing houses where they pick crabs and ship crabs. And this is their way of life. It is their entire way of life. And if it went away, it would be more than just, a few jobs lost, or we wouldn't be able to eat crabs. And
it could go away altogether, though.
Right. And Hooper's
if you don't do something about it.
I'm saying Hooper's.
Take a year off and plant trees.
Hooper's is just one place. There are many islands and towns like that in Maryland and in Virginia that just absolutely revolve around these things. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't consider these things. I'm just saying that when we consider these things, we need to consider the entire picture and remember that, there are many factors that are contributing to this decline. And fishing pressure is one of them, but it's not the only one. And I just, sometimes the easiest answer isn't the right answer. Okay. Do you know what I mean?
I know it's complicated.
So,
just to my point, relieve the one pressure that we can relieve, and that is our harvest for 1 year. Okay, enough from me. Bethany says, honestly, I wouldn't eat anything out of the bay. I've done water testing. I've lived on it for years. I have found heroin needles washed up on my beach and all sorts of horrible stuff. The crabs are probably relocating south because of how bad our water quality is. Back in the days of Columbus, the bay was as clean as the Caribbean, but then people happened. Crabs aren't the issue. It's us. Fix the cause. Fix the problem. Laura says that when I was growing up, we had crabs once a summer, and that was the norm. You could not get crab cakes year-round. People are selfish and spoiled now. They want to use everything up with no concern for tomorrow. I would be more than happy to give up crabs and anything else that comes from the bay for a year if that's what it takes to help the overall health of the bay. Gene says, limits and restrictions haven't worked, and yet people want more limits and restrictions. What am I missing? There's too much politics in Maryland's seafood business. And Carol says, if crabs were as expensive as most other seafood and there were fewer feasts where half the crabs end up in the landfill, all-you-can-eat feasts, right? Perhaps we'd have a more sustainable resource. I was talking to a restaurateur a couple of Saturdays ago who said, the idea of farm to table is great and having all this fresh local food and fresh fish all the time, but it's not possible.
Right.
It's not possible all year round. And he made the same point about us, what our expectations are.
Well, it's also really, I mean, that's the way I try to eat. And it's extremely expensive and it doesn't keep very long. So you're pretty much going to the grocery, you know, or the farm stand every 2 or 3 days to get more food. So, you know, it's tough and it's, you know, we don't want to keep going to a restaurant and paying $25 for an entree. And that's kind of what it's going to cost if we want our food to be all local and sustainable.
Ed in Baltimore. Ed, go right ahead with your comment, please.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. I work for an individual who steams crabs, sells crabs to local bars. He buys them from the watermen, cooks them, steams them, and sells them. So the industry itself employs a lot more people than watermen. And I heard, you know, telling the watermen to take a year off, well, that's not in having them plant trees. But what about the guy that steams the crabs? What about the bars that have $1 crab nights and it generates tons of revenue for them? You know, it's a multi-level business, these crabs. And just to say we're going to compensate the watermen for their time off would still be leaving a lot of people high and dry.
Okay, Ed, I'm with you. I appreciate your point. But we only had 19 million pounds last year. So those businesses you cite, we're not using all Maryland and Virginia Chesapeake crabs. It's as simple as that. I highly doubt that they just were all local crabs. So compensate in some other way. Get more crabs from out of state, or just I don't know what to tell you. If it goes away completely, then they're going to be nowhere.
Right.
So what I'm saying is do something drastic for a year or so. Declare another emergency. Get some federal funds to help people out. Let them make claims.
Is Ed still with us?
We're out of time here.
Okay.
What did you want to say?
I was going to ask him how many of the crabs that he steams and works with
come
are local.
From Maryland. Yeah.
I was curious.
Yeah. I wonder about that every time I go to a restaurant. Anyway, we're out of time here, Rona. Thank you very much for being with us again today. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. We want to tell you about the Chesapeake Bay Journal because they collaborate with us on this show once a month here on Midday. You can get a free subscription, right?
Yes.
Mailed to your house.
Yes.
Or you can go online and read the Chesapeake Bay Journal at Chesapeake Bay Journal.
It's bayjournal.com.
It's just bayjournal.com.
Bayjournal.com.
You think I would know that by now. Bayjournal.com. Well, I have a bookmark on my
Bayjournal.com,
computer.
And we also have a Facebook page. Please like us, and I put things on there all day long. So.
And you're going to update Facebook
with the
information about the grading of the tributaries.
Yes,
right?
I will.
Thank you. You're so diligent. Thank you very much, Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Thank you, everyone, who tuned in this afternoon. And please, we'll continue this conversation about crabs. So send us emails. I'll read them all, and we'll follow up another day on this very subject.
Sounds great.
Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.